From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, in the wake of recent revelations about widespread surveillance on and collection of cell phone data in the United States by the National Security Agency, we'll talk with our foreign policy contributor about NSA programs past and present. Then the author of the novel Life After Life muses on the origin of characters.
It sounds like madness. All writers will say characters appear fully formed and they don't know how that happens. And I don't. They're suddenly there. I don't construct those characters. I don't sit down and put bits together like they're, you know, dolls I'm making. They just appear and that's them and the character is quite fixed.
And musician Trapper Shep talks about not letting the success of his band go to his head.
I think we're all on the same page and have no delusions of where we're at as a band. We're still a baby band, and getting to where we have, I think, in part has been because we haven't had colossal expectations.
Lake Effect comes your way next after the news. Good morning and welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. President Obama is in Europe this week for the G8 summit in Ireland. His reception by Europeans is a little frostier than it's been in past years, in part because of the controversy emerging at home over surveillance and scrutiny of phone and internet records by the National Security Agency, measures that some European leaders had been critical of in past U.S. presidential administrations. But if the reaction among Europeans has been strong, it pales in comparison to the controversy that has brewed in this country since the U.K. newspaper The Guardian first published its report on the government's access to cell phone records, and NSA contractor Edward Snowden came forward as a source of leaks. Some members of Congress have complained that they've been left in the dark about surveillance and national security issues, while the Obama administration and other members of Congress have defended the programs, saying they're needed to help keep the country safe. But Lake Effect contributor Art Sear believes it's worth looking at how the NSA has conducted past surveillance programs. Sear, who directs the A.W. Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College, tells Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke there's not much to distinguish what the NSA is doing today versus what it's always done.
I actually don't think it is that much different. It comes in the wake of 9/11 and the comprehensive inconvenience we all suffer, especially but not just at the airport, as a result of the very explicit terrorist threat, but there is nothing new about the federal government engaging in surveillance of American citizens.
Well, so what do you make of the reaction to the disclosure that the government's been collecting things like cell phone records and doing internet surveillance of Americans on a wide scale? Why is there this hue and cry now?
Because Americans don't care for authority and because it's much more public than it used to be. Congress is much more active, which creates problems in terms of leaks of information and the fact that it's almost impossible for most members of the House and Senate to actually keep secrets when revealing something might be helpful to their election. Nonetheless, we have much more public surveillance, if you will, of the government today than in the past. And especially since 2008, the Congress has been very active and I think overall responsible, despite what I just said, in interacting with and learning about what the government is doing.
Is there a difference, though, in how much easier it might be for the NSA to do its job? I mean, people are connecting with each other in ways that they did not used to be able to connect to each other. Does that in some ways make the collection of data about people easier?
Yes, I think it's a matter of technology. I'm not at all sure that human interaction, and certainly human nature hasn't been changed, human interaction has been changed, but thanks to extremely sophisticated algorithms, pervasive information collection, we really don't have any privacy. And I say that with emphasis. We don't have privacy in the way that we used to. At the same time, we still have relative anonymity because there's such a vast amount of data being automatically, through automation, collected that it's in some ways as difficult as it always has been to collect information about specific individuals in a really focused way.
The message we hear from the Obama administration, in addition to the point that they are not the first administration to do this kind of surveillance, is that there is no sense of national security without these kinds of measures. Do they have a point?
I think they do. The president so far has not – if they are misleading Congress, especially given other imbroglios related to Benghazi and that sort of thing, the president could be in some serious political trouble. But so far, I think he's acquitted himself persuasively and effectively. The government during the Vietnam period engaged in extensive, much more human and personal surveillance of people. I served in the U.S. Army Reserves and on active duty, although mostly in the reserves during the 60s and early 70s. And my branch happened to be military intelligence. During that period, the U.S. Army, as well as the CIA and the FBI, engaged in extensive and very focused surveillance and information collecting on individual Americans. In many ways, that was more insidious than what's going on today.
Some of the complaints have been over the secrecy under which this has been carried out and the kind of rubber stamping the surveillance requests get from the court that oversees this. Is there a question we ought to be asking about oversight, like you know, who keeps an eye on the people that are keeping an eye on us?
You're referring to the FISA courts,
right,
established in direct reaction a few years ago to the felt need for the rule of law to have oversight in this activity. I disagree with the characterization of rubber stamp. There are 11 federal judges. Federal judges are scrutinized through the appointment process, as we all know, because of political conflict. They tend to be very serious, very effective, and dedicated professionals. The rotating judges, I think, helps undercut dangers of an old boy network or too much familiarity with the intelligence people you're dealing with. I think it's been handled pretty professionally. I don't minimize the potential for danger, and also I can't say emphatically enough that you don't have you don't have privacy today in the way that you used to. I'm constantly amazed at how people, not just college students, but others, including people in sensitive jobs in Washington, will communicate by email and put the most inflammatory and casual and embarrassing things down in email. That is public information for all practical purposes. Since the 1960s, we mentioned military intelligence. We've been talking about the NSA. Since the 1960s, any telephone conversation is subject to government monitoring. That's been going on for a half a century if they want to do it. You don't have privacy, and don't assume that you do.
Should we be asking ourselves questions?
I think it's a very healthy debate, and I'm sure it'll go on for a while, and I think that's a very good thing to do. I think what's acceptable and what's unacceptable behavior in the intelligence realm should be debated all the time. One thing that's not being discussed much is the fact that the most recent notorious leaks were done not by civil servants, military people, government career professionals, but by a contractor for Booz Allen and Hamilton. The growth of military and intelligence contractors using corporations for gathering and analyzing information, a trend that really exploded with the first Gulf War, I think is particularly insidious and should be discussed in a way that it isn't so far as I know.
It's interesting in the privacy discussion, there seem to be a lot of people very upset that the government is able to do this. And at the same time, if you spend any time online, Google and Facebook and any number of other corporations are doing similar kinds of data mining, and we don't seem nearly as upset about that. Is there anything practically different, or is it really saying something about Americans and our attitudes towards the government versus our attitudes towards the business world?
I think that's a very good point, and basically I agree with you. It's something I think about a lot. I think we're suspicious of both public and private authority. The state is different. The state can take your life legally. The state can destroy your life in a way that private corporations cannot, and certainly not as easily. Apple had brilliant marketing leadership under Steve Jobs, but just before his life especially, he was emphatic in articulating very persuasively and clearly his corporation's commitment to protecting the privacy of their consumers. It's a debate that goes on. I think Apple sets the standard for corporations. Microsoft hasn't done nearly as well. Google is doing better. But you're quite right about what's available in the private sector. Our college is extremely strong in GIS, Geographic Information Systems, reflecting the fact that the University of Wisconsin is very strong in geography. There is a billion-dollar private corporation, ESRI, that has, so far at least, a lock on GIS technology. We've raised money at our Clausen Center, and our students especially and faculty have carried out research for government and business using GIS technology. I don't even need your address, just your census tract, your zip code. If I know roughly where Mitch Tyke lives, it's almost frightening the degree of information we can collect about your likely educational background, ethnic, racial background, how you spend your money, again, to a frightening degree. And it's important very much to keep in mind that we are being tracked passively all the time.
Well, and so I wonder if to get back to the first question about what's different about this, is part of this the intersection between what the government is collecting and what corporations are collecting and
yes.
whether the government has access to what the corporations are already doing?
Yeah, that's right. I think that's one thing that makes private contracting insidious. It's also a sign of laziness on our part as citizens, laziness and complacency that we're willing to contract out to a corporation, guns for hire, military activity, as well as supply and intelligence and other activities. MPRI, Military Professional Resources, Inc., is not nearly as notorious as the former Blackwater. But they have worked not only for the Pentagon, but they have worked for governments which are on our State Department list as terrorist states. There are literally guns for hire. And there's very little that's been published on the subject.
Let's move to a slightly different topic here. President Obama is in Europe for the G8 summit this week, where he is being met by a fair amount of criticism over how long it took for the United States to support the rebels in Syria. Why did it take so long?
I think President Obama is extremely reluctant to use force overseas, and that's something I applaud, the judiciousness compared to the recklessness, especially of someone like John McCain, his opponent in the election of 2008, someone I admire a lot personally. And I supported McCain, in fact, very directly supported the campaign in 2000. But he's much too reckless, especially in old age, and interventionist. I think the judiciousness that President Obama, given the extraordinary military power we command, dwarfing any single European country, and for that matter, even the rest of NATO together, is to be applauded. The Europeans are also more directly involved in resources questions. That's why they took the lead, which worked out okay, in Libya. They're far more dependent on Middle Eastern oil than we are. And frankly, there is a residual sentiment of anti-Semitism in Europe that is far stronger in this country, in my belief.
There's more anti-Semitism in this country?
No, there's less. There's less, which is why we're much more strongly and consistently committed to Israel and generally more reluctant to intervene in the Middle East on behalf of the Arab states. There's far less anti-Semitism in this country than there was until and after World War II. I think the fading of that, along with obvious racism, is huge progress in the U.S.
Well, and so how is the U.S. involvement now likely to affect the direction of the Syrian conflict?
I think it automatically puts an emphasis on working together, and it will be harder for any single European country to go it alone. The umbrella of NATO automatically becomes stronger. Hezbollah is now very active in the Syrian rebel effort. Thanks to the efforts of Israel, I'm quite willing to criticize their foreign policy. We now have Hamas and Hezbollah, which used to be enemies, working together thanks to the hardline foreign policy of the Netanyahu government. Hezbollah fought the Israeli military to a standstill in Lebanon the first time that has happened. This civil war is extraordinarily intense and bloody. If we intervene on the ground directly, which I think would be a huge mistake in a public manner, I think it's a recipe for expanding an already very bloody war. We also rather arrogantly, and here Americans, I think, despite Vietnam, we tend to be more casual than Europeans about assuming that we can automatically intervene and therefore change the nature of what's going on in the country. There is a kind of arrogance that's associated with our great power that I think is part of the explanation for our strategic blunder in invading Iraq.
And finally, back in January, you made the case on this show that that Turkey was going to be a big story this year in some way, and that is proving to be the case. What do you see the unrest in Turkey representative of, in your estimation?
Well, thank you for mentioning one of the occasions I turned out to be right and not other occasions where I clearly was wrong. There's a sharp division between the Islamic population that is religiously committed and the rest in Turkey, even though it's 98-99% Islamic technically. It is also a very secular constitution, country, and society. the religious party that is currently in power has highlighted that basic split between the secularists and the others. Prime Minister Erdogan has so far stopped short of sparking a really violent crisis, especially with the army. However, he's kind of playing a Putin game. He wants the office of president of the country, which has been largely ceremonial, to get some real power. And then I understand his plan is to move from being prime minister to being president. I think this obvious abuse of authority, more than anything else, in his increasingly autocratic, imperious ways, a danger for any chief executive, is the principal reason why there's this problem.
Art Sear, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch. Always a pleasure.
Art Sear teaches political economy and world business and is the director of the A.W. Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He's our regular foreign policy contributor, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Teich. Coming up next, we'll talk with author Kate Atkinson about her newest book, Life After Life. Stay tuned. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. What if you had the chance to live your life again and again until you finally got it right? In British author Kate Atkinson's newest novel, Life After Life, Ursula Todd is born and dies. Ursula Todd is born and lives. And as the book progresses, the plot lines interweave and fold back on themselves as Ursula lives and dies in her many timelines. Some of those timelines are quite short, others quite lengthy and detailed. And through it all is the hulking shadow of the Second World War and the London Blitz. Life After Life finds Atkinson exploring chance and fate and how the smallest action or inaction by one person can profoundly affect the course of history, both personal and collective. Atkinson was in Milwaukee in April on a book tour, and she stopped in to talk with us then. Kate Atkinson, welcome to Lake Effect. It is such a pleasure to meet you.
Oh, thank you.
Beginning again and again and again, I think it's something that many of us would like to be able to do, to correct something that we think, oh, if I'd only been able to do this or known something differently or chosen a different path. Ursula Todd gets to do this throughout the entire book, over and over.
But she's not aware she's doing it. And I think that's the difference. I've been thinking about this because if you get to choose, then you think, oh, I'll do this differently or I'll take a different path. But actually, all she knows is a kind of déjà vu. She's not aware of those past lives. So she actually keeps making mistakes at the same time as she unconsciously corrects the others. So she doesn't have that much power. Someone else was saying that to me the other day. Oh, she gets to correct her mistakes. But actually, she's not even aware of it. So it's a different thing, isn't it? So she's not in the place where she can go and put, you know, £100 on the 310 at Cheltenham or the lottery or something. She's just kind of nosing her way through it in a way that I think is very uncomfortable for her. But she does rectify mistakes, but only out of kind of instinctive thing. Something sort of kicks in her brain and she says, oh, no, I won't step out onto that roof, you know.
Do you think that that's something that we all have, that sort of instinctive, if we listen to that still voice in ourselves?
I don't think many of us listen to that still voice.
No, I don't think we do, but I wonder if...
I think maybe we've grown up, you know, I mean, we're still Stone Age people. Our bodies are still Stone Age. Our brains probably still are. And I'm sure that if we lived a much more natural life closer to nature, we would actually live on our instincts a lot more. But we're so used to, as a civilized, and I use rabbit ears when I say civilized, society, that we've grown away from those things that we instinctively might think is, you know, it's not a good idea to go around there because there's the woolly mammoth that's about to pounce on me. Well, I don't know if woolly mammoths pounce, saber-toothed tigers maybe, but, you know, we've become so enmeshed in concrete and steel and a different kind of life that I don't think we do live by instincts.
One of the things I loved about reading this, the sense of her growing into herself.
Definitely. And I think those lives that she's living again and again, it's more like the image I would use is more like layers and layers and layers, so that her character remains the same. She is the same person. She's certainly the same person almost from when we first meet her as a baby, I think. But those layers of experience somehow make her stronger. Even when she's still prone to making mistakes and saying hello to that wrong person, she's still growing in a different way to the way that you and I would grow. You know, she's not on a journey. She's on some different kind of narrative.
The image that came to mind is like the fabric of her is getting more and more tightly woven each time I meet her in her next life.
Yes, that's a good image.
Life.
Yeah. And tougher. She gets tougher. All the time she gets tougher.
And funnier.
Yes, yes, she is. She becomes drier and more likable, I think. Well, she's not unlikable to begin with, but I think she becomes more and more a fully rounded person until, you know, when we leave her at the end, we have a very full picture of what she's like, I think.
The other very central part to this book is the Second World War and events leading up to it. The war itself, the Blitz in London, plays a huge part. And those particular timelines where she's in London were for me, I mean, just heartrending. And so I felt I was there. And what is it about the Second World War for you that made putting her in that particular time and place?
I would like it to have been me, I think. I would really like to have lived through the war. I know some people think that sounds sick, but actually I think it would have been an astonishing experience. And most people, you say that, you would go, oh my God, I wouldn't. The only other person who has instinctive, no, I know a couple of people who've said, oh God, yes, I would have lived through the war. And one of them is my cousin who's a soldier, and the other one is a woman who's written about the fiction about the Second World War. But I think to live your life at that heightened pitch must have been extraordinary. It is a unique event. Well, every event is unique. Every second is unique, I know. But that is something that will never occur again. We will never find ourselves under those conditions again. Even if we were to go to war and be bombarded, it certainly wouldn't be like that. And I think, you know, the Blitz lasted, oh, I don't know, 56, 57 days, 58 days, nonstop. It went on longer than that, but that was nonstop, nightly and sometimes daytime raids. And the effect that had on people, it made them, I think, more callous in many ways because they were seeing a lot of death, but it also made them more looser in all ways, you know, both morals and thinking and philosophy, because if you think that there's a chance that you might die tonight or tomorrow, then you do look at your life differently. So I think people probably viewed their own mortality in a very different way from the way that we do, because we live our lives as if we're going to live forever, whereas they were living their lives as if they might die tonight. And I think that's a interesting, fascinating thing. But also you do hear people say, particularly women, saying they had a good war and they enjoyed it, even though it's not the kind of thing that they should say. It's not very, you know, PC, but nonetheless, they enjoyed the freedom, I think.
For Ursula and for that time, you've said that this is sort of an exploration of what it meant to be British and what it meant to be English at that time. What do you think? What did you find out about being English at that time writing this book?
Oh, I don't know. You want to say it's about being English, but really maybe it's just about being in those circumstances. I think perhaps I stopped thinking of it being like that so much. But in a way, I mean, I wanted to recreate the Second World War for me, so that by fictionally recreating it, it's the only way I would get to live through that time, and in a much safer way, obviously. But I know it's difficult, because also then you start thinking, have I been infected by propaganda? But I think it showed up, you know, the stoicism of people, because when you read the actual, say, mass observation diaries, rather than looking towards propaganda, people are just getting on with things. They really are in a very rather downtrodden way. They're more interested in where they can get a torch battery from or a can of beans than they are really about their existence. But I don't know. I think there's a point in the book where Ursula says, you know, this is what I'm fighting for, and it is England. But what she's fighting for really is home and family. It's Fox Corner, where the family are. It's her brothers and sisters. It's what she's grown up with. That's England becomes a very small thing rather than this big patriotic, you know, we must fight.
And everyone's probably fighting
for their own little corner, yes.
Right.
Yes, I guess.
One of my favorite characters, Miss
yes.
Wolfe.
Yes.
And she talks about the importance of bearing witness. And I think that resonates throughout the entire book, because Ursula is almost bearing witness to her entire life over and over.
I was very pleased when I wrote that, because I realized that was a point I'd been working to without knowing what the sentence was that I was going to put there, because, you know, the Blitz is the heart of the book, and the book's always, for me, it was going to be about the Blitz. But it was, I didn't know what it was I wanted to say until Miss Wolfe says it. And I think for me, in a way, I am bearing witness, because I now am bearing witness. As they said, in the future, people will bear witness to us. And I am that person. I mean, obviously, I'm not alone, but this is my way of bearing witness to them, I think. And so it goes on.
I was so viscerally in that place and that time. I could smell it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't live through that. I'm not even English, you know. But there was something about the way Ursula lived through all of the various timelines, because she was in many different ones during the Blitz, that it just really struck. The other side of that, which I also found fascinating, is that you have her in timelines where she was not there at all and she was in Germany.
Mm. I can't really pinpoint the moment at which I thought she has to go to Germany as well. But I think because there is a her half-sibling who was adopted and is taken away, is brought up in Germany. In a way, it felt to me that there was a Todd, a member of the Todd family over there. And they do talk about him. And they say, funny to think that that baby is now the enemy. And there is an equality there. The Germans and the British, they're very alike. They're, you know, we're civilized. Well, again, I've got the rabbit ears here. But we're civilized European countries who have a long culture, with, you know, and at the beginning of the war, many English people were very upset that we were at war with Germany because they had friends in Germany, they'd visited Germany, they'd holidayed in Germany. And so there's this sense that, you know, what is the difference given the right circumstances? I think, as Ursula says in the book, it could have been us. You know, and that's something that's never popular when I say it. But, you know, there is a parallel there. And, of course, although we remember the Blitz, it's, you know, written into our history so very brightly, what we did to the Germans was infinitely worse. Germany was destroyed. There was fears that Germany would never, ever recover as a country, that it had gone because it was bombed so much. So it seemed only right, in a way, to go over to the other side and experience that for her.
Did you find, as you were working through these parallels and these, like, I'm trying to even find the right word. It's not repetition. It's the sort of the reversal and return and mm-hmm. starting out again. Mm-hmm. Were there some stories that simply just didn't work, that you had to abort and say,
No, somebody asked me this, I think, the other night. Did I get rid of a lot of things? Did I go back and, you know, things didn't work? And no, I just wrote it. It just was literally one sentence after the other. There was always just, it flowed as a book. It really did. I hardly rewrote it, to be honest.
I find that fascinating because it reads that way. It reads very seamless
for
something that isn't a linear narrative.
Yeah. No, there's a rhythm to it, though, because and that rhythm is the base. She lives, she dies, she lives, she does. So that I think that life, those lives flowed in a way that the writing followed them. I think it was one of the easiest books I've ever written. And I think it was because also I was very emotionally engaged with it, so that, you know, some books you're more emotionally engaged with than others. One hopes one's always engaged with the book that you're writing. You just always like the book you're writing. But I think with this one, I really felt it on the pulses somehow.
How about the ending? Was it difficult to figure out where to stop?
No, I always knew where I was going to stop.
Really?
I generally know where I'm going to start, where I'm going to stop. It's just the middle bit that's difficult to fill in.
Those other 500 pages.
Yes, and that thought develops very strongly as you're writing. More and more you realize that this is the place that you're going to. And it's lovely to have a goal. I would hate to be writing in a completely open-ended, because I write in an open-ended way, but I do know the end. And so there's always somewhere to go. So that's kind of comforting when you're stuck in the middle of those 500 pages.
Do the goalposts ever shift, though? Yeah, you have an idea, but does it ever tell you, you know, wait, no, we're really going to go over here?
Not really. Sometimes I had a, shall I do this or shall I do that moment? Shall I let her get away with it or shall I not? And for a long time I thought I wouldn't let her get away with it. And then I just thought, no, that's so cruel. Let her get away with it. So it was a kind of, that's a big shift by the sound of what I'm saying, but not really, because that was always the place I was going, was Tracy and whether she got away with it or not. So no, it's curious, because you would think that you're going to write all those 500 pages, you would change your mind about where it is you're going. But on the whole, I always end up there. Which is a miracle, honestly.
Well, I've heard other writers say that sometimes the characters dictate to them where, you know, it's like you said about Miss Wolfe, not knowing what you were thinking until she said it for you. And I was thinking, well, maybe sometimes Ursula or another character might say, you know, no, really, I want to go over here, you know, not there.
No, I think, you know, one does talk about characters as if they have lives of their own. But, you know, ultimately, I know that I'm in charge, and that because it would be kind of madness if they were in charge. But it's the way you develop them, I suppose, that takes you And the new characters suddenly spring. Because I love minor characters. So sometimes all those little minor characters that pop up, they're kind of, you know, they make you change slightly in direction. But on the whole, no, they don't. I don't know. I find character endlessly fascinating because, although, again, it sounds like madness, all writers will say characters appear fully formed and they don't know how that happens. And I don't. They're suddenly there. I don't construct those characters. I don't sit down and put bits together like they're, you know, dolls I'm making. They just appear and that's them. And their character is quite fixed, really, for the rest of the book. It's only their experiences that develop them, not anything in their real true nature. So, and I know that sounds slightly at odds with the idea that they're dictating, but I just don't understand character, and I would really like, I don't know, some kind of maybe a writing coach or a writing neurologist or somebody who could really explain the processes of what it is, what is happening when you're writing, because it's an odd thing, because a lot of it's unconscious, I think.
And there are some amazing small characters that may only be in one chapter or may have a through line also that parallels or that pops in different ways. Do you have particular favorites in this book? I have a couple that...
Well, I do particularly like Miss Wolf. I think Miss Wolf, in a way, is the moral center of the book. And I like all of the dogs. But Teddy, Ursula's baby brother, is always the real true heart of the book because I think it's for him that she, in a way, does everything, I think. And what happens to her, I think, is dictated by just that one love as well as the love of the whole world, I think. The two become meshed together, I think, for Ursula.
I also love her relationship with Pamela.
Pamela, yes.
I adore Pamela.
Yeah. She's very straightforward, jolly hockey sticks English girl.
And she says it so bluntly.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
But it's just... She's so refreshing,
and
I like her a great deal. And her insight and the foil that she provides for Ursula is just lovely in all of the different permutations that happen.
And they're always very close. They always, you know, they never fall out. They always love each other, which is nice. I have no siblings, so I have to invent all these siblings.
The siblings you wish you had.
Well, only the good ones, not Morris,
not Morris, the elder brother.
Someone said to me at an event in Canada, were you aware that you were making Hitler seem more attractive than Morris?
I hadn't put it that way, but you did, actually. I also like Hugh very much.
Oh, I love Hugh, yes.
Yeah, that's your dad.
He's a wonderful English gentleman. He's very sound, very, very sound. No, it's yes. Yes, I do like Hugh. It's funny that you talk about your characters as if they're somehow people.
Well, in a way they are, and
no,
for the readers,
no, they're
too.
Not.
But they're not.
I know, they become like people. I know, I'm aware. Sometimes I do have to be careful because someone will tell me how much they love a character. I'm like, really?
Is there anyone in here that anyone has told you that? And you've thought, really, you like that person?
Oh no, I can't remember. Somebody told me how much they disliked someone. And I was, no, someone told me, it was a Canadian journalist, I think, who told me how much they disliked Pamela. And I was like, why? And I thought, no, they must have completely misinterpreted her character because there's nothing unlikable about her, I don't think. But no, they totally dislike Pamela.
Interesting.
It's funny, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
It is how people react to that, as you say, as if they were actual people.
Yeah.
So now, what's next for you? Are you on another book?
Not really. I'm sort of thinking about another book. I've always planned to do a companion book to this, called A God in Ruins, which is a quotation from Emerson, Man is a God in Ruins, which I think is the most wonderful. I've really just been looking for a book to have that title, but it's Teddy's story, and more the grown-up Teddy, I think. So I haven't quite settled on how to make Teddy move from one book to the next, because he's always really, in a way, I know he grows up in life after life, but in a way he's always a little boy, so I have to find the grown-up Teddy's character.
And in a way, he's almost a reflection
of
Ursula.
He's a cipher, yes, he is. So making Teddy come to life is a challenge, actually. That will be, in a way, a construction of character in some way. So it might not work, I don't know.
Well, we'll see.
We'll see.
We'll see. The book was one of those that I sat up until 1 a.m. to finish. Not because I was late. I actually finished it a week ago, but I couldn't put it down. And as things started to get more and more wrapped up and I started to see where you were going. It's like, I want to know what happens to this person. So thank you so much for writing something that made me want to do that.
Oh, thank and you. That's very kind.
It's such a pleasure to have you here, Kate Atkinson. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Kate Atkinson is the author of Life After Life, which is published by Little Brown and Company. Atkinson is a prize-winning author of 6 novels, including Behind the Scenes at the Museum, which won the Whitbread Award for Book of the Year. She lives in Edinburgh when she's not on tour, and she was in Milwaukee in April, and she spoke with us then. We'll take one last break and then return with the story of a Wisconsin star on the rise. Lake Effect will be right back with an in-studio performance by Trapper Shep and the Shades. You're listening to Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
Sam, won't you please take me west to Wyoming, down the valley, can we go?
Regular Lake Effect listeners will recognize Trapper Shep's name from the weekly credits on the show. Trapper worked in various capacities on Lake Effect for 4 years while he studied at UW-Milwaukee. But to say he's gone on to do interesting work since then is a vast understatement. We interviewed Trapper and his band, The Shades, not long after their first CD, Lived and Moved, was released. But the band's 2012 release ushered in a breathtaking year for a young band, putting them on the rock and roll map far outside the borders of Wisconsin. Run, Injun, Run was the band's debut album after they signed a record deal with Los Angeles-based Side One Dummy Records. The songs marry a keen ear for songwriting detail with a rock, country, and folk tradition. With the release came great reviews, tours with the Wallflowers and Soul Asylum, and music videos as well. It's been a fast rise for the Ellsworth, Wisconsin native. Trapper Shep and the Shades are back in Milwaukee on a break from their national travels, and they found their way to the Lake Effect Bungalow for a chat with Mitch Tyke. They started with a song from Run, Injun, Run called Tracks.
Won't you please take me west of Wyoming, down the valley. Never come back, let the dust rise up and cover our tracks.
Trapper Shep and the Shades playing Tracks in Lake Effect Studio C1. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Welcome back to the bungalow.
The bungalow feels warm.
Well, before we go any further, because I'm sitting in a different part of the studio than I usually do these interviews, Trapper, let's go around the room and have y'all introduce yourself.
I'm Trapper. And I play guitar and sing.
My name's Graham. I play guitar.
My name's Johnny. I play drums.
I'm Tanner. I play bass.
The song you just played, Tracks, there is a really interesting backstory to that one, if memory serves. What inspired Tracks?
If my memory serves, I was just getting a bit tired of sitting around Milwaukee, I guess. And I really wanted to get out on the road and be playing shows. And we were kind of just stuck playing around Milwaukee, Sheboygan, Madison, all these cities that are great, but we weren't moving anywhere other than that. So I wrote a song to express those feelings of wanting to move farther from Wisconsin, basically.
It's like a speculative road song.
A speculative road song. And it's fared pretty well because it's on the album that has helped us go basically everywhere in the United States this last fall.
Well, and I wonder, is there something similar about this feeling you had about wanting to get out of Milwaukee? If you flash back years before and you were playing in Ellsworth.
That's exact. I couldn't say it better myself.
Your latest video is also for that song, and it's a really cool video. How did it come about?
Well, I've always been a bit camera shy, I will admit. But we met some really rad film dudes from Chicago that our label hooked us up with. And we just had this broad idea of capturing a road trip from Ellsworth to Milwaukee. And we didn't have a whole lot of specifics or other ideas than that. And we went into it with that kind of, again, a broad idea.
There's an iconic Mercedes at the heart of it.
The iconic Mercedes, which is the namesake of the album Run Engine Run, which my grandpa gave to my brother Tanner and I about 5 years ago. And yeah, it turned out well, I think. It's fun to watch. My dad helped a lot, thanks to him for getting the car up and running. So when I first told my dad, he was like, there's no way we're bringing that car out in the winter. And I was like, well, we need the music video now. And he's like, all right, I'll see what I can do. So, yeah.
Trapper can't drive stick, though, so.
Tanner is
so
my chauffeur.
That's why you were behind the wheel for the.
I was the chauffeur. It's driving this.
It's also a weird stick, too, in his defense.
That's four
it's a stick
on the tree.
But by the wheel.
I can write a song about an old car, but I can't really drive an old car very well.
You've toured before. You've been touring for a long time. But is there something different and more relentless about the kind of touring that you've been done when you get back to Milwaukee after one of the versions of the tours that you've done in recent months? Is it a different kind of tire than when you drive up to Sheboygan and back?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. I've been reading this book, Harry Chapin's autobiography. And he talks a lot in that book about when he first started touring a lot, and he describes it as being a good tired, and you know, just that feeling of the accomplishment and being worn out all the time, but it being a very celebratory sort of tired. And I think these guys would all agree that getting back from tour and seeing the signs for Milwaukee, it's a great feeling.
I have a whole bunch more questions, but this is a perfect segue to have you to play something else. What are you going to play?
We're going to play a new song called The Ballad of Olaf Johnson, which is about one of my distant relatives who got caught in a blizzard and decided to make the best of it.
At the turn of last century, in the heart of Hardin County, a Swedish immigrant by way of Chicago had to go, had to go, had to go. He came late in the fall with all his wagon could haul. He felt the cold wind against his cheek. It'd be below zero by the end of the week. He took a good long look around, then dug deep in the ground. He flipped his wagon upside down over a hole where all was brown. The wind went all night, and he cried ooh in fright. No bootleg whiskey could keep him warm, but he had shelter from the storm. After 7 long days, yeah, thought about leaving, but he might as well stay. He couldn't feel with his fingertips. He couldn't lick his dried out lips. He dreamt about women and glasses of beer. You
wake up screaming, but no one could hear. The wind went, ooh, all night. And he cried, ooh, in fright. Spent 2 months down in the ground, like some fox had been chased by a hound. He came up and he didn't make a sound. And he ran and he ran and he never was found. The wind went, ooh, all night.
Awesome stuff. Trapper Shep in the Shades in Studio C1. And Trapper, as you well know, I love a good story song, and that is a good story song.
Yeah. I am full of them, as they say.
Or full of it.
Or full of it, depending which way you look at it. I wrote that one after reading a USA Today article about that family legend. I was like, oh, that makes
sense. Did you like know
song.
He was like related to you before or after you read that article?
I read the article because it was emailed to me by my mother, and she said, "We are a family full of persevering good folk." And with that link, and I read it, and and
I can just picture your mom saying that.
It was something like that.
Well, and maybe this is an obvious question, but you've been writing songs for long enough that how do you think your handling of that story and its song possibilities turned out today versus what you might have done with it if you'd heard about that story 5 years ago?
If I heard about it 5 years ago, the song would be very vague and no one would be able to follow the storyline and there would be a lot of ambiguity there. But I've paid a lot more attention to detail, making every word count as I grow as a songwriter. I think so, at least.
And he has me, like, complaining and suggesting things every second.
Yeah, we're all a team with this, so.
Well, and you're a team that has a record label behind you, and you're meeting up with the Jacob Dylans and the Rhett Millers of the world on the road. How do the contacts that you're making in this business and having the record company behind you affect what you're able to do?
It's another tool. And the music industry and working at this, you have a big toolbox and you're just grabbing tools here and there. And some people are able to help you out more. The owner of our record label always says, we're looking for champions of Trapper Shep in the Shades, people that can... that are really willing to go that extra mile and help out and not just say, oh, I like this band, but actually acting upon that. And like Jacob, for instance.
Yeah, he was part of the reason that Joe Sib, the guy that runs the record label, or Bill Armstrong, one of them, that runs Side One Dummy, was part of the reason we got on the Wallflowers tour
because yeah.
He's a good friend of Jacob's, I think.
So Joe Sib, one of the owners of the label, we would call him a champion because he... good buddies with Jacob Dylan. He was nudging him along and we had a few other minor connections to the Wallflowers, and I'm a big fan, and I can speak for all of us, I think, in saying that their album Bringing Down the Horse has been...
It's got some jams on it.
It's got
some
great
tasty
jams
90s
on
jams.
Yeah. So well, we were all really happy to be a part of that tour.
And at some level, even though you have become this successful band in its own right, is it still a little surreal when you're invited to go on stage with Jacob Dylan and perform?
Yeah, there's the video of us doing one headlight with them at South by Southwest. And I think in that video you can see us all kind of looking around at each other like, okay, this is new.
So the success you've had, do you feel like it's also attached a bunch of higher expectations on what you do?
No and yes. Yes and no. It's a tough question. I mean, having our first big tour come with the Wallflowers, it sets a precedent with us. We should be able to get big tours like that, and we always should be able to do that, and that's completely unrealistic. I mean, we have just scratched the surface as a band of paying our dues, and I think we're all on the same page with that and have no delusions of where we're at as a band. We're still a baby band, and getting to where we have, I think, in part has been because we haven't had colossal expectations. But at the same time, you have to balance that and have high expectations, because you don't want to be 14 hours out of the way on a tour playing some show to no one.
Well, so before you go, first of all, let me say thanks to all of you. And Trapper, we really are proud of you back in the Lake Effect Bungalow.
Thank you, Mitch. It's an honor to be here again.
It's been a real slice, Mitch.
Thanks for having us.
A real slice, Mitch.
And Trapper, what are you going to play us out with?
I'm going to do a new song by just me and my lonesome, and it's called Dear Prospect, and it's about my good friend Paul Henneke, who got drafted by the LA Dodgers last year, and he's currently coming up in the Farm League right now. And I'd like to think we're kind of playing in the Farm League of the music industry right now, too. So.
Dear prospect, won't you please pick me? Last season,
Trapper Shep and the Shades played in Lake Effect Studio C1 back in April, and they spoke with Mitch Tyke. Our interview was engineered by John Strelecki. The band will open for the Old 97s concert at Turner Hall this Thursday, the 20th of June. There is more information on wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And that is all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us. I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.
Dear prospect, did you forget about me? I'll be your...